is going to have his second lecture on QFT basics.
All right, thanks a lot. So for those of you who weren't here on Tuesday, we talked about path integrals. And as I explained on Tuesday, the idea was to give a lightning introduction to some facts about quantum field theory that will be useful in the rest of this conference. If you already know quantum field theory, then if I recognize you, you probably aren't supposed to be here. But that's OK. So we're in the big room today. Don't let that discourage you from stopping me to ask questions. I want to make sure that everybody is on the same page here. So the basic thing I explained on Tuesday was how I'm going to start. By the way, the topic of Tuesday's lecture was Euclidean path integrals. The topic of today's lecture is the ambitious question, what is a quantum field theory? Before I get to that, I'm going to spend 5 minutes going over both what we did on Tuesday and the focus lecture that Mark Mazet gave following up on that, in case you missed that. So on Tuesday, we talked about the fact that path integrals correspond, can be translated into operators. So the operator e to the minus tau h translates into a Euclidean path integral that I've drawn schematically here. What this picture means is that you should do the integral over fields on this strip of size tau, and I've left cuts at the top and bottom of the strip. The cuts mean that, well, what is an operator? An operator is a rule that turns two classical field configurations into a number. In this case, that rule is that if I hand you two classical states, phi 1 and phi 2, then you should do the path integral with boundary conditions phi 1 and phi 2. But we don't have to plug in the bras and kets. We can just think formally of cut path integrals as operators where we'll stick in the fields later. So an important application of this was covered by Mark in the focus lecture on Tuesday. I just want to state the result because it's going to be, I think, used throughout the 2 weeks and is important. So the result I'll state in 1 plus 1 dimensions, but applies in any number of dimensions. In 1 plus 1, space is a line. And we might be interested in the reduced density matrix of a half line. Call that region A. Then, as I explained at the end of the lecture on Tuesday, and Horacio started to explain in the entanglement lecture yesterday, the path integral representation of the reduced density matrix on a half line is given by a path integral with two cuts on the half line. So again, what this picture means is that if I want to calculate matrix elements of the operator row A, then I should do the path integral with boundary condition phi 1 on the bottom of the cut and phi 2 on the top of the cut. Now, what Mark explained, and I want to tell you, is the operator version of that row A. OK, so here we had this path integral on a strip. And in operator language, that path integral was e to the minus tau h. Here we have a path integral on this funny cut plane. And I want to write the operator for that. So to turn this into an operator, let me draw the picture a little bigger. What we're going to do is we're going to imagine slicing that plane in polar coordinates and think of the states in the canonical formulation of field theory as living on these slices that go around in polar coordinates. Well then, what we're looking at here, this double cut path integral, is just like the double cut path integral that we had on Tuesday. So we can immediately read off the operator. Let me call it R hat. So R hat is the operator that is like it's the Hamiltonian for rotations. It's just the rotation charge. In Lorentzian language, the interval, so let me draw a Minkowski picture, real time t, then region A is a half space. Whose causal development is called Rindler space. And this operator R, so remember rotations, all the symmetries of Euclidean space are just rotations, so this is one of them. When you take a rotation in Euclidean space and you reinterpret it in Lorentzian signature, that rotation is going to mix up the space and time coordinates. So that's what we call boost. So rho A is e to the minus 2 pi times the boost Hamiltonian. It doesn't really have a standard name. I'll call it Q boost. So this is the reduced density matrix on Rindler space. And if we compare this to the usual thermal density matrix, we can immediately see that physics in Rindler space appears to be thermal at a temperature 1 over 2 pi. But now temperature is interpreted with respect to the boost Hamiltonian as opposed to the usual energy. So it's a thermal state, mixed thermal state, but the ensemble is defined with respect to boost charge as opposed to energy. And this is the origin of temperature in Rindler space. You can think of this as the origin of Hawking radiation as well, where the pictures we're drawing here are the near horizon region of a black hole. This is the black hole horizon. Often this is explained using modes of free fields, but it really has nothing to do with free fields. It's just a statement about the reduced density matrix in Rindler, and you can see it immediately from these path integral pictures. Okay, so that's the last thing I'm going to say about Euclidean path integrals. Are there any questions before we go on to part two? This one here? Yeah. So this means that if you do a path integral with boundary condition phi 1 here and phi 2 here, then that path integral can be calculated by, in operator language, this transition amplitude. So this is the usual, if you think of R as being the Hamiltonian, then this is a very ordinary kind of thing to calculate. So it's just a different version where instead of using the ordinary Hamiltonian, you use the rotation. Okay, part two. So part two is, what is a quantum field theory? I'm going to be sort of sketchy here and there, but on Tuesday, every question that there were many questions that had to do with whether things I was saying were well defined or not, and I basically deflected those questions. So now I'm going to sort of tell you why I deflected those questions and why that's a reasonable thing to do. I'm not going to do that by telling you why everything's secretly well defined. I'm going to tell you why we don't care. Okay, so what is a quantum field theory? Well, here's one. This is a scalar field. In d dimensions. The interaction term, so the first term is a kinetic term, second term is a mass. This here is the interaction term. This is the interesting part. And this particular interaction term corresponds to a two-particle contact interaction. So we have two particles coming in. Then what this term tells us is that those two particles can do something and come out a different way. And that this is somehow dependent on G. That weak coupling, it's actually given by G, but more generally, it somehow depends in some complicated way on the coupling G. Now, quantum field theory is always in second quantized language, but let me remind you what a term like this corresponds to in the language of ordinary quantum mechanics, ordinary undergrad quantum mechanics. So in first quantized language, a term like this corresponds to an interaction potential V of x1 minus V of x1 minus x2 equals G delta of x1 minus x2. So if you were going back to your undergrad quantum mechanics class and just solving the Schrodinger equation with some V in there, then this is the V analogous to interactions like the phi-fourth interaction. And what I wanted to draw your attention to is the fact that this is a local interaction. In other words, it's an interaction built out of a delta function. This is always the case in Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. As required by causality. Because in a Lorentz invariant field, in a relativistic setting, things have light cones. And if we do something here, then we're allowed to influence inside the light cone, but not outside. If I gave you anything, any kind of interaction that was not point-like, an interaction, say, a two-body interaction with some, I don't know, power law potential, say, then you would always be able to influence outside the light cone. So unlike in ordinary quantum mechanics where you can just put in any V you like, in quantum field theory, you have no choice but to use interactions that happen at a point. There was a question up there somewhere?
Yeah, I was confused because locality in quantum mechanics is different from locality in quantum field theory. Is if I interpret the formula for V as a quantum mechanics, in quantum field theory, the X is because of the
parties. So that would be two parties
there.
No, I really mean that I really mean that, okay, so in a non-relative, let's imagine we're doing a non-relativistic field theory where I can talk about a fixed particle sector. I mean, the second quantized language of quantum field theory is just a rewriting of many-body quantum mechanics. And what I'm giving you here is the is the formula in many-body quantum mechanics, which, when recast as an equivalent quantum field theory, would give a phi to the fourth term. So it's not as simple as changing x to phi. I really mean that this is the same theory as that one, rewritten in a different language. Other questions? Yeah, okay. Okay, so think back to your undergrad quantum mechanics class and whether you did a problem set that involved a delta function like this. I think I can probably answer that for you. You probably did this in one dimension. But I highly doubt that you did it in more than one dimension. Because if you try to solve this problem using undergrad quantum mechanics, then everything you calculate will be infinite. This is not a fact of quantum, just a fact of quantum field theory. It's true just for non-relativistic interactions at a point in ordinary quantum mechanics. So correlators, well, in quantum field theory, correlators, but in ordinary quantum mechanics, you might try to calculate, say, scattering off this potential, and everything you calculate will be infinite. This comes from the fact that we're talking about point-like or local interactions. So this particular infinity has little to do with the fact that we're doing quantum fields. It has most, it's mostly because I think it's more physical to think of it as a fact coming from the local interactions that we've input into this model. Now, the difference is that in quantum mechanics, if you were to write a local interaction like this, what you probably really have in mind is an extended potential that you're approximating by a local interaction. And you wouldn't worry too much about those infinities because it's just an approximation. And in the short distance limit, you would figure, well, it's really going to be replaced by whatever the exact true smeared out potential is, and it's not really interacting at a point. So that'll take care of all the infinities. The difference is, in quantum field theory, that the symmetries, the causality, requires everything to be point-like. And there's nothing you can't do anything to get rid of these infinities without doing something a little bit brutal to your theory. From a path integral point of view, what's happening is that when you have interactions, perturbatively, you can imagine bringing those, you can, if you have interactions up in the exponent, you can perturbatively bring them down into your path integral. And when you have operators inserted at coincident points like this, so you have four phis here, and they're all inserted at the same point x, then this leads to divergent integrals. In momentum space, those divergent integrals come from the contributions at arbitrarily high momentum. So these kinds of processes get contributions from all scales, and that's what's leading to these divergences. Okay, so it's infinite. What are we going to do now? Well, that might seem to suggest that the physics and the deep, that the things we that we observe and calculate in the infrared depend on the physics in the deep UV. That can't possibly be true. Okay, if that were true, we'd all know the theory of quantum gravity. We could just collide two rocks together and extract from the UV divergences in that process, we could extract everything there is to know about the ultraviolet and head home. So that can't be right. What must be true is that somehow, although there are divergences in the ultraviolet, these divergences don't affect the things that we actually observe in the infrared. So that's the story, and that is how it works out, so I'm going to describe quickly how that works out. So to actually calculate things in a divergent theory, the first step is to regulate. So for example, you could impose a lattice cutoff where the lattice spacing is A. Often in field theory, it's more convenient to impose a cutoff on momentum as opposed to position. Those two things are similar if you think of the momentum cutoff lambda as being at the scale 1 over A. Okay, so the first step in calculating anything is to impose this cutoff. Now everything's finite. Okay, so the good news is everything's finite. The bad news is that this is really no longer quantum field theory. It's not Lorentz invariant. It's not causal. We've really done something brutal by deforming this theory and cutting it off in the ultraviolet. So what next? The second step in calculating anything is to renormalize. And basically what that means is that we're going to agree to only talk about things which are insensitive to this brutal deformation of the theory that we did in the UV. Let me give a simple example. If we calculate in this, oh, I should have kept that. Okay, if we calculate in this scalar field theory that I wrote a minute ago, the 2-to-2 scattering amplitude, in four dimensions, then if we calculate that in perturbation theory, we're going to find a leading term that's perfectly fine, goes as G, but at subleading orders in perturbation theory, we'll find things like G squared log of the cutoff over some function of the momenta of the incoming particles, or equivalently of the scattering angle. Let me write that as a function of the scattering angle. The energy and scattering angle, plus corrections at higher orders in perturbation theory. So this is infinite. The calculation, we've deformed the theory by putting this cutoff, and we did some calculation. It gives an answer that's infinite. But this function here doesn't depend on the cutoff. So this function is an example of something that's universal in the sense that it's something we're allowed to talk about in quantum field theory. It doesn't depend on the fact that we brutally cut off the theory at a scale lambda. So renormalize the theory intuitively means that we only talk about the physical quantities that are insensitive to the cutoff. So we only talk about things like this. We don't talk about things like that. So the procedure is to first cut off, then renormalize in order to talk about universal quantities. So there are lots of things that are universal. For example, low energy scattering. That was the example that I gave there. There are things like correlation functions, O1 of X1, O2 of X2, dot, dot, dot. As long as you restrict to X1 minus X2 being much greater than your cutoff scale. So things like this have universal pieces which are independent of how we chose to deform the theory in the UV, and those are really the pieces that we mean when we talk about the predictions of our quantum field theory. So this is why I deflected any questions about the well-definedness of path integrals and quantum field theory on Tuesday. It's because what we really mean when we talk about quantum field theory is that, yes, various things are ill-defined and sensitive to exactly how we exactly how we deal with them. But those aren't the things we talk about. We only talk about the things that are well-defined. So that's the story. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm getting there. Yeah, but what Daniel says is true. You know, the fact that physics works tells us that exactly the things that are universal are going to be the same as the things that we observe in the lab.
We're not playing a trick here.
Going back to this expression here, note that as we change what we mean by the ultraviolet cutoff, lambda, that what happens to this scattering amplitude can be absorbed into a change in the coupling constants. So that is, if we promote G, the coupling, to a function of lambda, the cutoff, then we can absorb all the dependence on the cutoff into this change of the couplings, and get rid of the cutoff dependence in our physical predictions. So this dependence of the couplings on the cutoff is summarized by the beta functions defined by lambda dd lambda of the couplings. What these beta functions describe is how the theory changes as we change the cutoff. You can also think of this beta function as telling you how the theory changes as you look at the theory at different scales. Because what it's telling you is it's telling you the dependence of physical quantities as a function of where you're cutting off momentum. So it's telling you the contributions to physical quantities from a particular momentum scale. And what that means is that this change in scale can be thought of as defining a flow in the space of theories. Okay, so this is the space of theories. I'm going to truncate that space in our phi to the fourth example is being parametrized by the four-point coupling G and the mass M. This scale dependence tells you that if you start with the couplings, you start with one value of your cutoff, lambda, and then you change your value of your cutoff, then you can absorb that into a change of the couplings. And move to a different point in the space of couplings. So the beta functions are telling you about these vector field flows in the space of theories. Yeah?
So what is the y-axis?
The y-axis is m. This is g. So more generally, we would have an axis for every coupling that you can write in the theory. And I've just written two of them. But there are, in principle, an infinite number of axes. That's right. These are there's two sort of conceptually different ways of thinking of this cutoff. One is as a fake imaginary thing that we stick in the UV in order to calculate things. And now I've switched to Wilson's view of what this cutoff means, which is that is as a sliding scale that actually allows you to separate the physics by scale. Yes, I have sort of pulled that sleight of hand, but the two are related. It's the same set. It's the same. All the equations are the same. All the cutoff is the same. The dependence of the couplings is the same. The physical interpretation is a bit different. Okay. So these families of theories that are parametrized by a sliding scale are Wilson's RG flows. This is, if you're used to the usual Wilsonian RG, this is the same. It's the idea that as you integrate out high momentum modes in your system, then you're left with an effective theory of the low momentum modes. So the effective theory at lower, if you decrease lambda, then you find for yourself the effective theory at lower scales. So well, it's the same. It's the same. So we're defining it as our cutoff on the momentum scale, but it's a matter of whether we think of this as being something way far into the UV. It's sort of a fake, or we can bring lambda all the way down to the scales that we're interested in, and then dependence on lambda encodes the actual dependence of physics on scale. So the difference is whether we think of lambda as being something way far off that we don't care about, or something down at the scales that we're actually interested in. But all the formulas are the same. It's still the UV cutoff. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, can't you just say that it really thinks that this is a function of a dimensionless ratio of U and lambda, and then you can differentiate it with respect to one or the other sign
change? Sure. Yep. Yes, I agree. Well, let me use Daniel's answer, okay? It's going to be easier to explain that way. Okay, so there's low scales. We're doing experiments at the scale E, and way up here somewhere, we imagine that there's a UV cutoff lambda. And when you define universal quantities at the scale E, which is the scale of your lab that you're interested in, you have to talk about universal quantities. So you can do that by absorbing the lambda dependence into G. But what they really depend on is the ratio of the scale that you're interested in. There should be some exponentials or something here, shouldn't there? Okay. No, I won't worry about it. Is the ratio of E and lambda. And so dependence, you can think of dependence on lambda as basically the same as dependence on E. So this fake UV cutoff lambda that we were imagining tuning around, the dependence on that scale is the same as the dependence of physics on the actual physical scale at which we measure things. Okay, so now I'm going to draw a picture that people who study conformal field theory like to draw, and I'm going to answer the question, what is a quantum field theory, in the way that people that study conformal field theory like to answer it. So a quantum field theory is an RG flow. It's an RG flow from something in the UV, where you can think of this scale as being going to infinity, to something in the infrared, where your scale is going to zero. And this is a very abstract picture. You have to imagine this this line as traveling through some enormous high-dimensional space of couplings. A quantum field theory, in the end, you specify something in the UV, and then you can ask how you're interested in physical quantities at all scales, and you can describe by an RG flow into the infrared. Now, something that I want to talk about, what I want to talk about in the rest of this lecture, is what happens at the endpoints. So let's talk about the infrared. What are the choices for what can happen as we look at this theory at longer and longer distances? Well, we might get nothing. That's one option. In a theory that has mass, where everything is massive, also known as the gap theory, if you go to large enough scales, then it's just empty. So if you go to scales much longer than the, if you go to energy scales much below the mass, then there are no more excitations. Your theory is just made of nothing. So we're not going to be very interested in that one. Yeah, that's I guess, an answer that's in between the two that I want to talk about. So I'm going to talk about scale invariant infrared. A scale invariant theory is a theory with a continuous spectrum and that's the other there are a couple other options. You could have topological theory. There's a couple other options that are sort of in between here. So one is a topological theory where you have no local degrees of freedom, but you have some topological degrees of freedom. Another is massless fields, like a free photon. That's another option. But I'm going to focus for the rest of this lecture on the scale invariant case. For reasons that I'm going to come back to later, theories that are scale invariant are often actually conformally invariant. So I may use these words slightly interchangeably, that the endpoints of these RG flows are CFTs. This is not always true. Let me postpone that for now and come back to it. But I'll probably end up slipping up and calling them CFTs when what I really mean is that they're scale invariant. In terms of the flow in coupling space that we talked about a minute ago, the endpoints are points where the physics is independent of scale, so these are points where your flow stops. So in this vector flow in the space of theories, these are points where your beta functions vanish, and those characterize the fixed points of this renormalization group procedure. Okay, so the basic picture is that, according to people who like CFTs, is that so now I'm going to refine the definition of a quantum field theory. A quantum field theory is an RG flow between a CFT in the ultraviolet and a CFT in the infrared. In other words, a quantum field theory is a CFT with some deformation. Now, if I literally put a CFT in the ultraviolet, that's independent of scale, so it's not going to flow anywhere. But if you deform that CFT a little bit, then you can get a flow from a CFT in the UV to a CFT in the IR. So this is my, this is our answer for now for what is a quantum field theory.
So does that include gap theories?
Yes, but in that case, by infrared, the infrared CFT is the nothing theory. I mean, there's just nothing. Yeah, the Hilbert space is just zero, and that's it. Well, no. Okay, so that's a good point. So if you start with a quantum field theory, there are two possibilities for what could happen as you go into the ultraviolet. You can find that there's, well,
for example, what does Q to E do? Doesn't it become sort of singular or something?
Yeah, so you can have sort of two choices. It can become free. Often the theories we talk about become free in the ultraviolet, so like QCD. It can it can go to a fixed point, like a UV CFT, or you can find that it doesn't make sense to go all the way into the UV, that you can have, well, yeah, so QED in four dimensions, I guess, has a Landau pole, is that right? Which means that you can't really extrapolate all the way into the UV unless you make the theory free.
So you're excluding it, you're saying QED is not a quantum field theory.
Well, I think he means actual QED.
If I can get it in the IR.
Yes, you can, you, yeah, I, no, it's,
was the answer that QED is just some effective theory, but it's not a real quantum field theory or something?
Yeah, I mean, it is a real, effective field theories are real quantum field theories, but it's not a full quantum field theory in this sense. Yes, I'll go with that answer. Yeah, if you know what your theory is exactly, in the you know, we don't usually think of, in an effective field theory, we don't usually imagine that we know everything about all the irrelevant operators. So then what you say is true. You can't necessarily flow into the UV. Yeah.
I think the lambda pole is at a much higher scale than the quantum gravity scale.
Sorry?
The lambda pole is at a much higher scale than the quantum gravity scale.
That's true. I think that's one way out. I think the Landau poll tells you that you have to eventually replace your theory by something else. Whether gravity comes in first or not, I don't think is essential, but it could be one way out. So let me give some examples of CFTs. So one is Wilson-Fisher in three dimensions. So this is actually the Lagrangian that I wrote at the beginning. It was d phi squared plus m squared phi squared plus g phi to the fourth. That's a flow. Well, there is a particular flow. From a free scalar theory in the UV to a particular value of the couplings, g equals g star, m equals m star in the infrared, and at this point the beta functions vanish. So at this point your flow hits a critical point, and this critical point, in the case of the lambda or of the g phi to the fourth theory, is in the same universality class as the critical Ising transition. In this case, the theory in the UV is free, that's easy. The theory in the infrared is actually strongly coupled. We know that there's a fixed point, but g star and m star, well, g star in particular is not close to zero. It's just some number. And so it takes a lot of effort to extract predictions from this strongly coupled fixed point. Here's another example. So there's a fixed point called the Banks-Zaks fixed point in d equals 4. This is a SUN gauge theory with NF fermions, where NC and NF are both large. In this case, actually, you can study this theory perturbatively at large N and find that there's a fixed point at G star scaling as 1 over NC. So this has a coupling constant which flows. You can follow that flow in perturbation theory. It's small all along the flow, and you can study that fixed point at large n. What about at small n? Well, if you make NC and NF small, then you can try to study this in perturbation theory. But before you're able to get, so you can start studying it and turning on the couplings and following your RG flow. But before you get to the fixed point, things become strongly coupled and you can no longer calculate anything, using perturbation theory at least. What's known to happen is that there are some range of NC and NF where this flows to a non-trivial conformal field theory in the infrared. There's a different range of NC and NF where it flows to gap theory, so like QCD in the real world. But actually, exactly what those ranges are in NC and NF is an open question. The last example that I'll write is a supersymmetric theory in four dimensions. So in four dimensions, there is a gauge theory with lots of supersymmetry. That's n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, maximal supersymmetry. And this theory is actually conformal at any value of the coupling constant. So this is a special case where the symmetries are so strong that you actually have a whole family of conformal field theories parametrized by the coupling. So some features that all of these theories share are that they have a continuous spectrum, they don't have particles in the usual sense. So particles are, particles correspond to a discrete spectrum. We better not have any particles. They don't have an S matrix. So if you're used to doing quantum field theory in terms of scattering amplitudes, you have to change your point of view a bit to talk about conformal field theories. The S matrix or scattering matrix is defined by taking asymptotic particle states and asking what happens when you throw them together. Well, if there are no particles, then there's no S matrix. So if there are no particles and no S matrix, what is there? And that's what I'm gonna talk about in the last half hour or so. So what is a conformal field theory? What do we calculate? What is the data and interesting observables that this theory defines? Okay, so I'm going to start by introducing the data of a conformal field theory. A conformal field theory has a spectrum. What I mean by that is spectrum under scale symmetry. So these theories are scale invariant. We should be able to characterize them by how things transform under rescalings of the space-time coordinates, x goes to lambda x. You can choose a basis of local operators that behaves nicely under this rescaling. That is, you have operators OI, which rescale as follows. OI of lambda x is lambda to the minus delta I OI of x. Delta here is called the scaling dimension of the operator O. And what I mean by this. So if you consider an operator as a function of x versus as a function of lambda x, those are two different operators that are related by this rule. Okay, so by the data, what I mean is that there's some list of operators and corresponding scaling dimensions, OI and delta I. And this list of of operators and scaling dimensions is, for our purposes, is discrete and infinite. So I is 1 to infinity. So the spectrum, in terms of the energy, the usual Hamiltonian, is continuous. But the spectrum, in terms of rescalings, is discrete. It's easy to check, and I think this was on the homework on Tuesday, that this property fixes the two-point functions of local operators. Be a power law. Well, first of all, you can only have a two-point function, a non-zero two-point function between two operators of the same scaling dimension. And secondly, that two-point function must be a power law. This one here is just a convenient normalization. By the way, in a free theory, this list of scaling dimensions would be a bunch of integers. In interacting conformal field theory, integers are very rare. You need a good reason to get a scaling dimension which is an integer. For example, I'll come to the stress tensor, which has integer dimension. But other than things that are dictated by symmetry, we generally expect not to have anything with integer scaling dimension. The second piece of data are the correlation functions between these various operators. Now, you might think that we could independently specify endpoint functions. Any number of local operators would give some new function. Actually, that's not true, because there are factorization rules that tell you that in fact, you can decompose any endpoint function into a product of three-point functions. So although we're interested in all of these observables for endpoint correlation functions, the only actual data are what is called the OPE coefficients. And these are the three-point couplings between any three operators. So these are functions of x1, x2, and x3, and there's some known function of x1, x2, and x3 on the other side. But the Cij, the OPE coefficient, serves as a coupling constant, and this is the other basic piece of data in a conformal field theory.
So the two-point function doesn't vanish if the
Yes. Now, these two bits of data, these two pieces of data, are not everything we care about in a conformal field theory. There are more complicated things that we care about. We care about, for example, the partition function. We care about the partition function on various manifolds. As I explained on Tuesday, the partition function with Euclidean time identified gives you the thermal partition function of the theory. But often we also care about more complicated and crazier manifolds to extract other properties of the theory. We care about non-local things. So when I talked about correlation functions, I wrote these as functions of x. These are correlation functions of local operators. But we also care about correlation functions of non-local operators. So for example, things like integral dx, O of x. So there's a spectrum of non-local operators that are also very interesting. I don't in 1+1 dimensions, it's known that these two things, the data one and data two, are everything you need to define a conformal field theory. And everything else you can talk about calculating can at least be in principle be reduced to these two sets of data. In higher dimensions, I don't, as far as I know, that's not true. I think it's, I think there isn't, as far as I know, there is not a characterization of exactly what it takes to completely define a conformal field theory in more than two dimensions. So that's an open problem. Yeah, that's still true, actually. So that's true in any number of dimensions. So, yeah.
So the data for this quantum field theory seems pretty similar to the data for quantum field theory.
Yeah, so that's not an accident. So the comment, if you didn't hear it, was that this data sounds a lot like the data that defines a topological quantum field theory. So one way to understand that is that that topological quantum field theories can often be thought of as two-dimensional conformal field theories. So there's a map, say, between Chern-Simons and rational conformal field theory in two dimensions. The big difference, if you're used to thinking about topological quantum field theory, then you're aware of the various consistency conditions that things like this have to obey and the transformation rules that they obey. And the big difference in conformal field theory versus topological field theory is that all of the sums and all of the observables are infinite sums of these data, of this data, and all of the consistency conditions involve infinite sums over stuff like this. And that actually dramatically changes the structure of how you impose the consistency conditions and how they end up being implemented in physical theories. So the structure looks the same, but because everything's infinite, it really changes quite a bit the structure at the end of the day. I think it's known that there are other things, but what's not known is how to characterize the full set of data. There's something in conformal field theory called the state operator map. So when I said that this was the full set of data, if you're used to thinking about states, Hilbert spaces, then maybe that seemed bizarre because at no point did I mention what the states of this theory are. I just told you about operators. So in conformal field theory, there's what's called the state operator correspondence, which is a one-to-one mapping between states and local operators. So on the one hand, you have local operators, OI, X. And those are in one-to-one correspondence with states I, where those states are defined on a D minus one sphere. So if we're talking about a one plus one dimensional theory, then these states would be defined on a circle. If we're talking about a higher dimensional theory, then they're states on a sphere. So remember that conformal field theory have a continuous spectrum, whereas the spectrum of operators is discrete. What's happened here is that by putting the theory on a finite volume, we've made that spectrum discrete, and now it can be in one-to-one correspondence with a set of operators. This will become continuous if we took the size of the sphere to infinity. Yeah. What I mean is that this list, There is no X. It's, yeah, OI. What I mean is that this list of operators is in one-to-one correspondence with this list of states. And The x dependence here, well, yeah, let me not get into the x dependence because there is something to say about the x dependence, but I won't. So I'll just briefly describe why this is true. First, let's go in this direction. Why does every operator define for you a state? Let me draw the pictures in 1 plus 1 dimensions, because I'm going to fail miserably otherwise. This defines a state because you can insert a local operator at the origin and do the path integral on a disk. Remember from Tuesday that a path integral with an open boundary, with a cut, where you're supposed to specify some data, is the definition or defines for you a quantum state. So any operator that I stick into this path integral here will define for me, so to match my notation on Tuesday, I should draw this squiggly. So this defines a state on the circle of unit radius. Actually, that step is true in any theory. I didn't use conformal invariance. So in any theory, you can insert an operator to get yourself a state. What's special about conformal field theory is the arrow in the other direction. So I'm not, okay, so I implies OI. The other direction, I'm not going to go into detail, but here's why it works. Well, suppose you have a state on the unit circle. In general, that's a very non-local thing. It's defined on the unit circle, not at a point. But in a conformal field theory, you can rescale everything. And that means that you can take this state defined on a circle and shrink it down and actually use it to define a local operator. So that's the step that uses the conformal invariance or scale invariance, and that's what gives you this very powerful state operator mapping is one-to-one in a conformal field theory.
So this is not a question about
Yeah. Yes. Agreed. Thank you. Yeah.
Do you have a basis of states that correspond to a basis of operators?
Of local operators. A basis of, well, we have to be careful. So when we say states, we have to say what space is. So if you have a basis of states on a sphere, then yes, you have a basis of local operators. How is it one-to-one? The two-point function. You can ask whether it has overlap. So say you were going to calculate a norm. You can ask whether it has overlap with other states. And if you want to calculate a norm by state operator, this corresponds to a two-point function. So if you have an orthonormal basis over there, then you have an orthonormal basis over here. Yep?
So in class integral, if we leave one boundary condition open and fit the other one and not be the state. But in this case, it seems like you don't have any boundary condition. So why do you need the state?
Well, the important thing about that you need for a path integral to define a state is that path integral has one open cut. It doesn't matter what's going on elsewhere, as long as it's as you have some way of defining what's going on elsewhere. The important thing is it has one open cut. Because what is a state? It's a rule that turns one set of classical data into a number. So as long as you have one open cut, you can use that to define a quantum state. No, there's only one open cut here. The cut is on the unit circle. The inside is where we're doing the path integral. And for example, if I wanted to calculate, if I had some actual fields here and I wanted to calculate the overlap of state I with some field configuration phi 2, then I would impose the boundary condition phi 2 on the unit circle and do the path integral on this closed disk.
So if I do start with a state and I try to get from that an operator, and as you say, I shrink it down until I'm at least approaching the limit of a point, how would I want, if I'm thinking of an operator as perhaps a classical data turn quantum using the path integral, how would I necessarily extract that?
So I think I better not get into the details of how you go in that other direction. I just wanted to give a cartoon, but we can talk about it afterward. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Check the time. Good. Oh, I should mention that in this mapping between states and operators, the scaling dimension delta I plays a key role. So the scaling dimension, which is attached to operator OI, corresponds to the energy of the state I. So the spectrum on the sphere really is, in the usual sense, the energy spectrum on the sphere, in the usual sense, is this data number one I had a minute ago telling you the set of operators in your theory. Good. So in the last 15 minutes, what I'd like to tell you about is tell you a little bit about the stress tensor in a conformal field theory. So the stress tensor is a particularly important operator that appears in every conformal field theory. There are various ways to define it. If you happen to know the Hamiltonian, then you can write it as integral of the energy density. And in a Lorentz invariant theory, you can extract from this the stress tensor T mu nu. For example, in a free scalar theory, T mu nu is just built from the scalar fields, d mu phi, d nu phi. But often we don't want to write the Lagrangian, or there's a more general and more useful way of defining it. And so it's always true in quantum field theory that, did I write something wrong?
Minus that quantum times d mu phi, your stress tensor is traceless.
Thank you. Yes. Okay, so it's always true that you can define, you can characterize an operator by the source that it couples to. And to define the stress tensor, what we do is we couple the CFT to a very special source, which is a background metric, g mu nu. Now, we're not doing gravity here, we're just doing quantum field theory, and we're maybe not even interested in theory in curved space, we're just interested in the conformal field theory in flat space, but we're going to define the stress tensor by first putting the theory in a fixed curve space-time. And then defining the stress tensor by taking derivatives that correspond to turning on little bits of curved space. We're going to take derivatives with respect to the background metric, and that defines this operator. In other words, the stress tensor describes the response of your system to infinitesimal deformations of the manifold that you put it on. This equation here you should think of as a rule for how to calculate correlation functions. So for example, if you have t mu nu inserted into some correlation function like this, and you'd like to calculate that correlator in your CFT, then the rule, what this tells you, the rule to calculate that is d g mu nu of x1, O of x2, dot, 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 in the CFT on a curved manifold, where at the end of the day, you evaluate this in the flat space-time metric delta mu nu. So the stress tensor correlators describe how correlators in curved space respond to the metric. What you mean here? Why is it missing here? I probably just forgot it here. It doesn't matter actually in the flat limit because it's going to end up being set to 1. But it should be there. It's just part of the definition though. The fact that energy is conserved tells you that t mu nu is conserved. And I won't tell you why, but this implies, so I'm not going to derive this, but this implies that the scaling dimension of the stress tensor is exactly the space-time dimension d. You can ask me after if you want to know why this is true. One way to see this is to calculate it in free theory, and check that it doesn't change in perturbation theory. But then if you go back and think about it, you can conclude that the reason it's not changing is because of this conservation law. So actually, earlier, when I said that we expect scaling dimensions to be just crazy non-integer numbers, this was the exception. So things that are conserved give you nice integer scaling dimensions, which don't depend on the coupling constant. Now, if we started with a free theory, and we turned on some coupling and flowed in the IR, is now strongly interacting, the dimension of the stress tensor is still exactly d. Okay, so now I can come back to the asterisks that I had earlier about scale invariant theories versus conformally invariant theories, and what is the difference between these two, and why is it that when we concluded that that RG flows terminate at scale invariant points, why am I spending all this time talking about conformal symmetry? So this is related to the stress tensor. Under the rescaling x goes to lambda x, the metric rescales by lambda squared. In other words, for an infinitesimal transformation, delta g mu nu, the transformation of the space-time metric, is lambda squared, is proportional to g mu nu. Let's look at how the partition function of the theory changes under a scale transformation. Well, by the definition of the stress tensor, up to factors that I didn't write, this is integral root g t mu nu delta g mu nu. All I've done here is taken this definition of the stress tensor and use the definition of a variational derivative. So the stress tensor is telling you, in particular, you know, I said the stress tensor tells you how the theory responds to deformations of the metric. But included in those deformations are scale transformations. So this is one of the reasons that the stress tensor plays such a key role in scale invariant, conformally invariant theories, is that all this business about the scale symmetry is encoded in how the stress tensor behaves, especially when you combine it, when you put it in correlators with the other operators. So let's calculate it. In the case of a rescaling, we said that delta g mu nu was proportional to the metric itself. So this is integral d dx root g t mu nu lambda squared g mu nu. And let's say at this point that we're just interested in small variations around flat space. Now, at this point, we're still just talking about conformal field theory in flat space. We're just putting this metric in as a source, as a trick, to understand what happens with the stress tensor. So now, at this stage, I can plug in the fact that we're in flat space. So root g is 1, g mu nu is just delta mu nu, and this is lambda squared integral d dx of t mu mu. That is, the behavior of the partition function under rescalings is related to the trace of the stress tensor. By assumption, we're in a scale invariant theory, so this integral over the trace of the stress tensor had better be 0. Well, one easy way to make it 0 is if the trace of the stress tensor vanishes, but we can be a little more general. This is going to vanish if t mu nu, t mu mu, sorry, the trace, is the divergence of something. It's to be the divergence of some spin 1 object. And when you act with the derivative, so now I want to impose the fact that the stress tensor had dimension d. Remember that the stress tensor has this very, very special integer dimension. And the only way that scale invariance can be satisfied is if it's the derivative of a spin 1 thing. But derivatives increase the dimension by 1. So this k that shows up here had better have dimension exactly d minus 1. Oh, that just means something with one index. Okay, so scale invariance requires that the trace of the stress tensor has this form as a total divergence, but often, and let me come back to what I mean by often, there's no such K. Your theory, there's just no way to find a, in fact, we don't expect there to be such a K unless there's an extremely good reason for it, because it's a, operator of integer dimension exactly d minus 1. So for example, in BankZax, where you can work perturbatively, you can just write down all the operators, write down everything you can make out of the fields, and there's just no candidate for k. When this happens, it means that t mu mu of x has to vanish. So let's recap for a minute. We assumed only scale invariance. We assumed that the theory was invariant under scale transformations, x goes to lambda x. That required the integral of trace t to vanish. But we concluded that generically, that actually means that trace t vanishes locally. And this is the origin of the conformal symmetry. That is, instead of just having x goes to lambda x, you can rescale locally by a function of the space-time coordinate. And the partition function will still be invariant. All that's going to happen in the analysis over here is that this becomes a function of x, but since the trace of t is vanishing, it's still a symmetry. So this is the fact that scale enhances to conformal. So these local rescalings, where you rescale by actually a different amount at each point in space-time, is a conformal transformation. And it comes from the fact that the trace of the stress tensor is zero. It means that it means that if you were to do that, you would, everything in that theory would be fixed by the stuff in the original theory, by some set of symmetry transformations. Yeah. If you remember the formula I had for, actually, I can't remember if I wrote this formula. Did I write this?
No.
Okay. Well, remember that the beta function was determining how the theory depends on scale. And all this business of the trace of the stress tensor generating scale transformations can be translated into this operator identity that tells you that the beta how the beta functions are related to the trace of the stress tensor. So again, from this equation, we can see why you might expect scale invariance and fixed points to actually truly be conformally invariant. What's the easiest way to get a scale invariant fixed point? Set the beta functions to zero, but then the trace itself actually vanishes and you get this whole big conformal symmetry instead of just the scale symmetry. Now, let me come back to often. This is a question that people have studied. When does scale invariance actually imply conformal invariance? And in two dimensions, the answer proved by Polchinski using results of Zamolodchikov is that in a unitary two-dimensional scale invariant theory, this is always true. Even in cases where you do have a K, a candidate K with the correct dimension, it doesn't show up here. That it's always actually conformally invariant. Scale implies conformal in unitary two-dimensional theories. There's almost a theorem in four dimensions. I don't think there's a theorem, or I don't think there's a candidate theorem in three dimensions, but maybe someone can correct me. Well, there are counterexamples, but I wouldn't count them for reasons that we can talk about afterward. Yeah. So I didn't derive that. It comes from the word identity. We can look at it afterward. But the basic point is that T mu mu, as I showed up there, corresponds to the response of the theory under rescalings. But that's exactly what you do in RG, is you rescale everything. So it makes sense, at least, that some equation like this would be true. We can, and the details are a little complicated. So I think that I'm basically out of time. Oh, basically over time. I'll just mention that this equality here is tricky. And that we have to worry about anomalies in talking about the trace of the stress sensor. And I think these will show up in Rossi's talk. OK, so I'll stop there. Thanks a lot. And feel free to stick around for questions.
So we're running slightly late, but maybe time for one or two quick questions.
Sorry? I couldn't hear.
In the derivation that scale invariance leads to conformal invariance, we assume that the metric was passed.
I couldn't hear the last part.
Did we actually have to use the assumption of the metric path to derive the result of scale invariance?
The question is whether we had to assume that the metric was flat in order to have this discussion of scale implies conformal. It's tricky. Once you have a non-flat metric, you're introducing length scales, and the meaning, what you mean by conformal symmetry, we have to be a bit more careful. So that what we mean by the words scale implies conformal is I think really a statement about flat space. But it does imply the thing. It does imply things about the theory on a curved manifold.
But are there any theories that they apply on a curved metric? If you just scale the metric up by a constant, then you get the same theory. But it wouldn't be true if you scaled it up locally by, you know, some function, some scalar.
I don't know the answer to that. Maybe someone else knows. Oh. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, then maybe we should take further questions offline. And thanks, Tom, again, for this lecture.